Step into a world where ancient wisdom meets modern mysticism. Introducing the Gnostic Tarot, a powerful fusion of esoteric art and Gnostic themes designed for those who seek the ultimate gnosis. This mesmerizing deck, rich in symbolism, draws from the profound teachings of Gnosticism, serving as an ideal companion for meditation, reflection, and the exploration of spiritual realms. Whether you are a seasoned tarot enthusiast or new to the practice, the Gnostic Tarot caters to all, offering a portal to ancient wisdom and a tool for uncovering the hidden truths in your mystical journey. Unveil the mysteries, embrace the wisdom. The Gnostic Tarot is a timeless companion for your spiritual odyssey. Take a journey with Gnostic luminaries and learn their stories in a visually stunning manner. From Sophia to the Gnostic Christ, their journey is your self-discovery. Choose from the basic deck or the deluxe version, which includes a beautifully crafted journey book and a magnetic storage box, ensuring that your Gnostic Tarot remains a treasured companion on your spiritual quest. The Gnostic Tarot is an original and collaborative effort between Miguel Connor of Aeon by Gnostic Radio and Matthew Schmitz of Altrusian Grace Media. Visit our website to embark on your journey today. Syncrasis Publishing, where ancient wisdom and modern mysticism converge. Welcome, everybody, to Aeon Bide. Welcome to the desert of the real. Welcome to the machine, my son, and the means to escape it. My name is Miguel Connor, your pompadus of gnosis, your Ubix spray, getting rid of that smell of colitas rising through the air of a world gone mad. Great to see everybody, and we have a very exciting show tonight. With us, it's always an honor and a pleasure to have the man, James True. James, how are you doing?
I am fantastic. Happy Tuesday. Great to be here. Good to see you both again.
Likewise. And with us, we've got the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing?
Well, Vance couldn't be here, so he sent in his clone. So here I am. Luckily, we transferred all my memories into the clone, so it should be an equivalent experience.
Clone or replicant? I wonder
if we got that. What's the difference?
Yeah, exactly.
We'll have to do the Mimpfomf-Kermpf test or whatever, PKD. I can never remember that test that they do.
Mein Kampf.
Mein Clone.
Mein Kampf. Mein Führer.
Yeah, I know. I thought it was so interesting because I enjoyed your book, Black Eye Club. Great. Wow. I read it in one evening because, again, I like the story. Of course, as usual, it's sort of fiction and you throw in your philosophies and all that. So it was a great read, but I was also thinking, my God, it's also so relevant with the Kate Middleton stuff. You know, it's be a clone. Is this a deep fake? Is it a hologram? Is it a body double? Like you say, James, it's the greatest apocalypse ever. So we can pick many conspiracies now, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. In fact, really the easiest way to really dive into cloning is to understand and even assume that you are a clone. And to begin from that process is the only way, I think, to fully fathom what it means. And in writing this book, I've never really woke up forcing myself to consider that I'm a clone and how I would go about my day. And more importantly, how that would feel to know that there was someone out there that shared my IP address on the network and that had the same visions, but also the same epigenetic starting point as I did. Because this really what a clone is someone who is beginning on an epigenetic journey at exactly the same waypoint with exactly the same character and all the fuel and all the offerings that come with them at exactly the same time. And this is giving us for the first time in, you know, maybe 12,000 years, maybe, is giving us for the first time the ability to look at ourselves in the mirror from this perspective I'm talking about and really start to profoundly pick apart some of the some of the gray areas that we've had about what it means to even be human. So this topic is deeper than I thought it would be. I'll just say what I thought was a sidebar really turned out to be just the heart of the essence of the ideas in this book.
Yeah, we're right back at Blade Runner and Replicants and Philip K. Dick. What it is human, mm-hmm. what's consciousness. What were you saying, Vance?
Yeah, what about identical twins? That was that they're natural clones.
Yeah. They have
the same genes.
Yeah, they sure do. And the one difference I would say, not that this is even a difference, but one thing that's interesting about clones is that the identical twins are starting with a clean slate on that IP address of their DNA, and they're starting it from the moment they're born. A clone is a little bit different because let's say that maybe we should talk about horses just because it's just easier to even begin. Okay. Sure. That way people know that when I'm talking about horses, I'm claiming that this is factual and you guys can prune my lips just like I encourage you always to do. But so if you start with like a 7-year-old horse, and I'm not a big horse guy, so anyone horse, you're going to notice I don't know any of the terms, so forgive me. I'm not trying to, I'm literally an ignoramus when it comes to that. But I do know about cloning. And when you clone a 7-year-old horse, there's a certain puzzles that have already been solved inside the pituitary of that horse. And those solutions are automatically imprinted in the epigenetics of that femur cell, or if you scrape the uterus and you pull out an egg and the gnosis inside of that cell is also duplicatable. So something something like a fear. I got to fix this. We got to talk about the word fetish sometimes, but a totem fear. That's installed in a piece of object, say a garden hose, is going to trigger a horse, and the horse is going to be terrified of the garden hose because it had an experience out in front of the barn with this one particular garden hose. Before that point, the horse had no fear of garden hoses. After that point, it did. This event changes the genes. The genetics of the horse are now different.
Okay.
And when you take that moment and then you clone that, you are cloning that fear of snake too. That is now incorporated in the system. So yes, it's as simple. The starting point is it's as simple as identical twins. The complex part is when you are cloning something that's already been through the pituitary ladder. They've gone through puberty, so to speak. But in a much more conscious way, not necessarily just sexual, although that's a huge part of it, but just certain parts of their personality, their balls have dropped. and now they're being born into a fresh body, but with this psycho genderfication that's already occurred. And to me, this is what makes it a fascinating field that's bigger than I first thought it was.
But James, you were talking about, you know, obviously epigenetics, what gets passed down, which atheism tried to erase from evolution. They've been tried very hard. But mm-hmm. So you're saying that you're a clone because so much has been passed down to you that's identical to your ancestors and other figures in history. That's what you're saying. You're not nothing new under the sun almost.
Yeah, absolutely. To unlock who we are, I believe really what we're doing is we're tapping into our ancestors, mm-hmm. and we're unlocking who they are, because they is us.
Right.
But in order to understand ourselves, we disassociate from our ancestors and we say, oh, that was my grandfather. And that's fine. But there's a point on the meditation mat where you're oming and you notice, I am my grandfather. I am the same thing.
I've had that, yeah.
And when you associate into this kind of thinking, I'm using the word associate because I want you to picture, like, if you're going to go roller skating and after an hour, you've really, really just fit into these roller skates. They're an extension of you. And so your grandparents become you. You start to function as a larger entity than you were before. You're awakening the halls of these other things. And I think cloning is actually going to show us how to standardize that process. Not necessarily because cloning's good. I think it's more because we're gonna clone ourselves. We're gonna step out of the dressing room and Target, and we're like, oh my God, I can't believe I look like this. And they're gonna run back inside, and it's going to give you a better understanding of who you are, I think. I think a lot of the haunting goes away. So it seems like a lot of who we are is really just epigenetic haunting. Mm-hmm. They use the word haunting because if you look at it as like an algorithmic spell, alcoholism is alkulhol, could be looked at as an epigenetic lingering that occurs, a supercritical kind of like brain theory, but inside of epigenetics, where a flavor or a taste or a habit is invoked simply because we see a stream go by, or we're dilated by certain things, or we have an event that mimics a trauma that we had, but I'm using trauma in a very broad term. It's more like mimics a dilation that we've had, because it's the dilations in the past that haunt us, and they haunt us from the side of wisdom, and they haunt us from the side of terror. And that both these things are serving us, which is why it's important that we start to demonize ourselves in a more educational way. We start to associate. When I understand the fabric of my grandfather and what he went through in his life, I'm sort of able to peel that apart from myself and then understand more about who I am outside of the clone versus who I was made from, because I'm going to suggest to you that I'm simply a clone of my grandfather. It seems to weave in between generations, by the way, which makes it harder for us to recognize these things and to see these things. And I think cloning is going to eventually show us, holy cow, this is how it works.
So you think that right now we have the technology to clone humans a la Stepford Wives, and it's being utilized?
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's no way that we haven't been doing this since at least the 40s. It's
40s. Whoa.
Yeah. So I know that there's a lot of fun truther kind of raise the hair on your back when you start to think about Nazi cloning and things like that. But I really just want you to look at it as, during the entire time while this idea was going on in America, the eugenics movement was a standardized like 4-H club. There, you literally went like, yeah. Are you going to the eugenics bakery? Yes, I am. I've made an apple pie, and we really like this color hue of people. And we really like people that are this tall. And oh, I'm so sorry, Meg, but your knuckles are not going to make it this year. So we're going to take you out back. And that this used to be okay because we didn't have enough complexity of civilized shame to curtail ourselves. So we outwardly expressed it more. And I think that what just as we were doing it in our societal Americas, the daughters of the American Revolution were doing it in their light kind of ways. Venezuela was like, we are making a cottage industry out of this technology. And it's seriously not that hard. When I say it's not that hard, the success rate of cloning is very low, but the technology involved to begin cloning is very easy. It is a low threshold to enter this business. You can start it out of a food truck. You're basically looking at just finding the right cell inside the body. You don't even need anything out of the uterus. You can do this from the femur. Sure. You can do this. Yeah. And so I could take any healthy adult, not me personally. I haven't tried this, although, you know, maybe if my book sells, I'll set up a lab, but you can take one of those cells, and with that same cell, it actually has both parts of the DNA that are actually inside of there. So really, you're just going to take both pairs of those DNA of that single female in this example. We can talk about males, just a lot more complicated, but that we can take both of those genes and in vitro place them inside of a somatic cell that's basically just going to be giving life to that genetic code. So this will be the clone. You're now cloning that adult. But you're cloning that adult. So we know from watching horses, and I'm so science, what we call science, watches horses. And so a lot of the science is very easy for you to access and to just see what happens. But I feel confident that certainly this would have been a big part of World War II, is simply just cloning families. In fact, you know, the CIA has neighborhoods, you know, outside of Lindley that they buy, and there, you know, there are families that live here. And I don't think that you have to go so far as to say, are you saying they're cloning them? If you want to think that, that's fine. But I don't even think it's necessary, because I think really you're looking at how is your dog trained, and what was your dog, did it come haunted with? Because the Border Collie is haunted by, I have a strong desire to bring things that are larger than me back into a circle through yelping and directional call. They are haunted by this. And as long as you get a clone that's haunted by that, you now have a breed that's going to be positive. So this is why I say the haunting is, we have to understand what haunting really is. It's just an algorithmic kickoff where things just kind of kick in. So that the same horse that's terrified of the garden hose is also going to kick right out of the gate faster than anything you've ever seen, because it has that same fast twitch that it was taught. It was taught probably because the horse that was cloned from it had such a dilating, i.e. terrifying experience, that its fast twitch muscles were able to develop more than anything else. And so that haunting becomes a necessary part of it, which gives it skill. So everyone that you see with natural talent is just possessed, right? They're possessed by a past. And we want this. We go out to find our ways. We want something to possess us. We will join the army. We will join the Marines because we want to go be possessed by what a horrible experience war can be. All these things prove our mettle, but also they give us the opportunity. I think mostly this is the thing we don't necessarily notice. This is the Hades part of it. They give us the opportunity to cleanse these things through war and other dilating experiences, but we don't consciously understand that secretly I'm terrified of this garden hose, and I want to go to the land of garden hoses so I can face my Dagobah fears as a horse, right? I'm going to go to the land, go into the cave that's full of garden hoses, and emerge from the other side a victorious horse. This is probably what drives us more. We're just not consciously aware of it.
Ooh, well said. Yeah, I think I'm thinking of the famous book that got made into a movie. You're talking about cloning The Boys from Brazil. And it was a huge hit. And of course, that's the idea that Hitler not only escaped, or they took parts of him to South America and they cloned him into all these kids, and some died, most of them died, and whatever. So, and I remember my godmother, she was like, oh, that's not a conspiracy. It's true. There's lots of Hitlers there. And then there's a movie that came out last year. It's called Infinity Pool. I don't think it's David Cronenberg. I think it's his son, but it talks about cloning and the ethical abuses of people who will clone, because then they can do whatever they want. Yeah. So,
a male horse, Adolfo Cambiasso is a world famous polo player, and he won the last, maybe not the last polo cup, but a very recent polo cup, famously using seven, I believe it was, could have been six. The symbolism interesting. I wish I knew. I think it was six cloned horses. And that during the match, all six clone horses were used. It's quite easy for me to read this story and go, oh, this is such a press release. Like, you know, that he's obviously, they want to push the idea that they're not hiding it. He's quite proud of it. And as I read into his story more, and all the science is there, it's just fascinating what's going on with the horses. A couple of his medical staff have actually quit because of the ethics. They've noticed these things about clones. And this is really what I honed in on. It was the guys that were fired from it. They noticed these things about clones, and they just didn't think it was right. And mostly from horses, they spoke more about the puberty. And although they didn't say this, I just imagine that your pituitary is, you know, your pituitary is putting out this signal, right? So it's like, it's three signals. There's your daily signal, your circadian rhythms, of course, is just giving you a natural, it should be 24, but believe it or not, it's 25 hours. It's actually trying to make you stretch weirdly. Your brain is always making you stretch longer than it really needs to be. So that's one cycle. But then the yearly cycle, you know, it's just listening to the environment and putting out, you know, different chemicals during the winter and different chemicals during the spring and things like that. But then a much larger clock is this puberty clock that goes off, and that your body naturally just the cycle completes. Augra notices the metal gears come into line, and boom, you know, your balls drop, as we say. You Saturn returns, and clunk clunk, you hear something, and you've now sexualized yourself. You have genderfied yourself. And I know that especially now with all the fascinating things that are happening with the trans movement, I think we've had this false assumption that we were born male or born female, but we're actually born amorphous, and we go through a process where we pituitarily become male and become female, or mm-hmm. actually become hermaphroditic. These are all three things that are built strongly into science, that these are the three avenues. Believe it or not, there really are three genders. I don't mind mm-hmm. us calling it two, because a hermaphrodite is simply, you know, you're just having both endocrine systems. But the point is that your innocence is lost once your pituitary drops. And I believe that what these doctors, if they had maybe better eloquence, not that I'm eloquently saying this, but they would have said it like that. They would have explained that the horses lost their innocence. They were never given a chance as a clone to be born into innocence, because they were cloned at a point in their life where they had already been here. Mm-hmm. They weren't handed off in a process through the garden. And that gardenary process creates a sealed doorway between this life and your life, simply because it's giving you a different genetic IP address, right? The male genes of the sperm and the female genes of the egg are joining in sex, and that those two things create a new IP address, and that new IP address has never had its pituitary dropped. But if you clone something that has the same genetic code, what I'm arguing is, and actually what these guys are talking about is that the pituitary is already dropped. These horses are already acting like they're male before they even know it. They can't be kept in the same paddock. They're ready to produce. They're months old and they're ready to fuck, excuse the language. Mm-hmm. And they don't know why. They don't understand what's going on here. And it's because the scientists say it has to be the epigenetics. There's no other link, is what they've said. In fact, these guys, before they quit, they wanted to fix this. They believe so strongly in this cloning stuff. They're like, how do we fix this? And they just couldn't. And when you add that to just the sheer failure rate, which is really high, you're looking at you're shooting a lot of things in the head. And I think that Argentina became a cottage industry for that. It's a clandestine country anyway. It's literally the one of the top countries where people go missing. Is Argentina. There's over 300 camps. You could find this on Wikipedia if you wanted. Over 300 clandestine human trafficking camps have been raided or busted or acknowledged there. Yeah, it's way more than any other place in the world. And I believe that you're just looking at the psychosis or psychology. I'm not even trying to be judgmental, because again, I think that if we need to understand this, let's call ourselves a clone. Let's do that. And then let's look at what's actually happening, because what's happening is that you're creating a psychological stalemate. And this, to me, this is what this book, the main theme of this book, I think really is this, is that when you have two identities that are sharing the same IP address, and maybe we should explain that, but when you have that, you're going to create an economy where there can be only one, where there's going to be a quickening. There's just nothing you can do about it. And I think that this, what's unwrapping in this book, is that if you just follow morally what's happening there, especially when you're looking at a powerful family, that's probably the case. Adolfo Cambiasso, this guy that won with six horses, is a billionaire because he's an oil tycoon. He's a professional athlete at the top of his game. He is a fashion icon. He's like bigger than Ralph Lauren, if you remember who that was, like worldwide. The guy's like drop dead. He's a good looking guy. Like he has all the traits of something that would be tailored, just as anyone who goes to the Westminster to show a dog, you would do the same thing with a person. And so when you look at this, you're looking at the potential for a group of clones. This is what I suggest in the book, is that these group of clones are incorporated. They've incorporated themselves as Adolfo, and it's seven clones that look alike, and that they started off with the same information, with the same starting point, and that because they were so rich and successful, they incorporated into where all of them had equal shares in this same identity. And then that's what decided who they did. And so you're watching this war, this civil war play out because the identity is being deteriorated because of really the profound theme in this book was really, I think, the profound theme of why we're here, mm-hmm. which is that the most special thing that you have is your originality, your unique identifier, your unique key is actually more precious than all the beautiful things you might do or might say. It's the fact that you have this unique IP address on this network that prevents anyone else from stealing feelings that you get to unwrap yourself, and that you wouldn't be able to do that. And as long as you're living in a world where someone can do that, you would have no choice but to either end yourself or end them or come up with some kind of solution, because this is not a way to live. This is you're being cheated, basically, is what I think ends up happening.
Really well said indeed. And for the audience, if you have any questions for James, please super chat them so we can separate them and we will get to them. I had to highlight this comment because this cracked me up. Was Jesus a hermaphrodite? I'm not going to touch it. James does talk about, I think you're right, there's only been 500 instances in human mm-hmm. history recorded of true hermaphrodites. I would say Jesus yeah. is a spiritual hermaphrodite, but a true hermaphrodite is a very rare thing, isn't it?
Well, it is rare, but it's definitely not unheard of. And you're going to have I'm trying to think of the word. I always have trouble remembering this word. But you have a completely different lymphatic system inside of you, and that's mm-hmm. being online. I as my friend Renee actually pointed out, if you think about the story of Mary, she's not allowed to have birth in a room, in a hotel room. Mm-hmm. They say there's no room at the inn, but really they're like, there's no room for you, Mary. You are weird. You're going to go have babies where animals have babies. You're going to go out to the manger and you're going to have a baby there. And when you do that, you're not going to need a father to impregnate you. You're going to do what a hermaphrodite was. It's called selfing. Yeah, a true hermaphrodite can self themselves. It's called selfing. It's hilarious. But it's like, if you want to insult a hermaphrodite, you don't say, hey, go fuck yourself. You go self. Like,
okay.
Yeah. They're like, yeah, I just did it yesterday. I'm literally the best
Saturday night date, man.
It's like one of the greatest things that I have going for me is that I can go self myself. So if you want to peel back the idea, it becomes very difficult to talk yourself out of that idea because of mm-hmm. simply the story of Mary itself. The what is a clone? It is an immaculate conception. The entire process of what we're calling this is immaculate conception. So when we go back to Adam Kadmon, if you read my last book, Ark of Baphomet, mm-hmm. for example, you know right. that the hermaphrodite is the original Adam, where we came right. from. And that there's a royalty that's there. See, this book, there's a hermaphroditic line that's been discovered, and that this woman is tortured her whole fucking life because they worship her because she has all of her parts. And when you're in the room with someone who has all their parts, you are going to either lust for them, have jealousy of them, go crazy over them, or want to kill them, or want to worship them, or just level the fuck up. And only one of those six is a good thing for the person. And so I think any hermaphrodite in history was just flat out just freaking everyone out around them at all times anyway. And so when you look at what an elite would do, if they found if you were an elite billionaire and you found a hermaphroditic bloodline, I think you would hoard it. And I think you would hoard it for a long time. And as royalty, you may not necessarily put it out in front, but you would want it to be your property. You would own that bloodline. And that there would come a time when a cottage industry that practices cloning, say Argentina, would want and pay for the most heirloomed human that it could find. And I cannot think of a more heirloomed human than a hermaphrodite. And so when we look at how we're going to survive the next reset, how we're going to undergo a cataclysm, mm-hmm. it just becomes a natural process for me to think that someone would consider a hermaphrodite a pretty important thing to have right now. It's like the world is ending. All we need is a hermaphrodite and we can fix this whole thing. Has anyone got a hermaphrodite? Because I'm going to go to Kmart, just buy as many hermaphrodites as you can and bring them back here, because there's going to be a science that's necessary to time capsule ourselves. And so this book really does wrap up just all of these things in one, but it's just set in a sci-fi story this way. So it's the same research that I give in my talks. It's just laid out in a story that I hope gives you an emotional compassion as to what it actually feels like to be a clone, because it doesn't really make sense that you would actually have a different name. There's a few characters in my book. I won't name them because I don't want to spoil the story, but they share the same name. And you might at first think, well, that doesn't make any sense. But if you really start to dive into this clone stuff, you would actually understand why they would prefer to have the same name. That there would be a psychology built in that would require them to until they quicken themselves and return back to a solitary again, which is the tip of the spear. And that's what makes us so special, I think, is because we are so delicate in that way.
Yeah, that's why I like the, hero, heroine, Lita. Mm-hmm. Because the name, I mean, I found great character, but I found her a bittersweet tragic because, again, the name Lita, the swan raped by by Zeus, by the Olympians. But in some stories, Lita gets turned into the fierce goddess Nemesis. And she's very pale. So I'm sure it wasn't an accident you called her Lita.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. In fact, Quantum Rapture, her daughter is a main character in that. Excuse me. And with her being in that, it was important to give some backstory in this, because the sequel deals a lot more with consciousness as being something. The deeper you go into the ocean, which appears to be Hades, in my opinion, that blueness that you go into, you're getting closer to consciousness. And so Orca, giant squid, Megalodon, creatures like this, a lot of creatures we just haven't met yet that are down there, leviathans themselves, would become more angel-like than, say, going up into space. It would be the opposite, that when we die, I think we secretly know this. The Oracle mythology, I think, actually knows this, because we decide that when we die, we're buried underground. And we're buried underground because I think heaven is actually below. Like Sheol is the original name of those who have gone before us. It's not necessarily and it sucks too. It's awful. At first it was like those who have gone before us. And then that came to mean, that sounds awful. They've gone. So clearly that's, and it's fine. But I'm just saying that originally it didn't necessarily have this connotation. In fact, we would embrace ADs. It's something that we would embrace all the time. And so if you think about what's happening when we're dying, maybe our bones are there because we're still quantumly entangled. So we're buried, but we're still in the room. Our bones are still there. All of our loved ones remember us. And so by extension, parts of us have to remain in this space. And so they do. So the real meaning of death, like to truly die, would be to release all of your entanglements. Everyone that's ever haunted you, everyone that you've already haunted, that when you die, you would have the opportunity, if you were good at this, if you could transmogrify, if you could step away and disassociate, because to die would be to disassociate from all these quantum entanglements, you wouldn't just sink 6 feet underground. No, you keep going. You just keep going and going. You would flux through the highest pressure, thickest things that ever were in this world, because none of them had any tangible hold on you anymore. And most of our religious experiences describe something much like this, this evaporation. I understand that a lot of our stories deal with heaven, but I really want people to understand that I think the reason why you've heard that those stories deal with a space that's up above is because of our obnoxious nature at transliterating the word Hades over time, and that we ended up having to turn it away because we had such a fear. In Greek culture, you didn't say Hades. You didn't say that word out loud. You used other words to reference it the same way Jews do that with God, right? Words like Hashem and all these other Adonai and all these other names that are names, but not really the name. It's because it's the same thing. But the reason why I think originally we didn't say Hades was not because we were terrified. It's because this is the unseen. We have reverence for the unseen because we are not able to perceive it. We're not able to describe it. So we do not talk about it as if we had the glory in our tongues to speak it. This is the exact same notion as the name of God, where we said, you're not worthy to say the name of God. And it would be the same idea as we're not worthy to talk about 80s because it's such a reverential place. And we respect it by not being able to speak about it.
Yeah, here's a quote from your book from, I think it's Blue Man, one of the characters. Hades is where we deny things out of existence. Ignoring something doesn't make it go away. It makes it invisible. See the difference? So yeah, there's these beautiful ideas of Hades that you weave in and out of the book. And
yeah, you know, that
reminds me. Go ahead.
Well, that's just so much. It's been so much of this science that we talked about for years with the aperture and things like that too. So that's why this book really writes itself. The science seems so built into it that the mythology just suddenly made sense to me all of a sudden.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, it made perfect sense. And yeah, for the audience, check out our interview on the Oracle of Mythology, because we talk about, yeah, going down how the Merkabah Jews, people didn't understand when they took a mystic flight to the throne of God, they went down, and people are like, why are they going down? Because that's the holy place.
Yeah.
And you see it over. And then interesting about the Mayans, people don't know what happened to the Mayan Empire, James. And one of the theories is that, you know, the Mayans, when you died, you buried your dead in your house. You honor. They weren't dead. They were just in a different state. Mm-hmm. So people thought eventually they ran out of people, and it became a necropolis. And don't you think maybe they reached that point where they were in Hades? They were, again, they were released from the karmic debt or whatever, and they just vanished.
Yeah. Yeah. And so much of this is that fear. And fear was, we had to become advanced enough to fear death. That actually was a necessity, to where we finally gained enough calories to where, oh my God, we can fear death now. Oh, this is going to be great. And when you do that, everything changes, and you instantly have to hide a lot of things. You have to remove a lot of your history that you used to do, you know, used to go over to Miguel's house 40,000 years ago and be, you know, hey Miguel. And he'd be like, hey, touch my grandparents' bones. And this is, and when you think about, It's almost like I want to write a whole book from this perspective, but one of the characters in this book has found a seed, an aboriginal seed, a genetic seed from a time of aborigines, and they actually have a place where these aborigines live because this museum's keeping them alive. And I was thinking about the psychology then, where everything would be red and black. All of the vision that they see would be, and that's pretty advanced. They can see black, white, and red, basically. And that red is a new thing. And that red is not necessarily the color in the environment. It's the color of what their mind is trying to hallucinate into them to get them to see more information. And so when you understand that this is truly how we see things, not only does it profoundly give you an impact into what it was like to be in the past, but it starts to allow you to experiment just how blind we are now and just how profoundly we'll be able to see into the future. Because if you integrate yourself with, this is a very trivial example, but this is just one of many. If you were to integrate yourself with some sort of an AI demon, just to get really freaked out here, but an artificial intelligence epigenetic demon that's running inside of your genes, just like you could install an addiction to alcohol through a lot of drinking, you could install some sort of AI software that gave you the ability to count super fast, to delineate super fast, okay? And so now you have this idea, this ability to delineate super fast, and what could you do with that? One of the things you could do with that is freaking speak Wi-Fi. Like you could discern and listen to a bandwidth signal, and more importantly, you could interpret the bandwidth signal and give something back. Which means that it would be quite simple for us to imagine a point in our lives where we would be online and not need any kind of interface to do that. That simply through our vibration, could we put these things out? I don't think there's any speculation here. The only thing we're missing is that resolution. That's it. And even with technology now, with contact lenses, with bifocals, we're able to see resolutions we couldn't see before. We have polarizing lenses now. You can see into the water and see a fish underneath that you couldn't see before. And if you come back to your Aboriginal time, imagine that no water was ever see-through, that all it was just a white moving glue. It looked like glue, and it moved super fast, and it looked like glue. And you could stick your hand in it and feel around it. Maybe you could grab a fish, but it wasn't until the first time you actually grabbed a fish out of there that you started to notice, I need to be able to see into this. And I think this truly is much more in the origin of where we are. And all of Greek mythology says James is right on this because it tells you about Hades. It describes it. This is the place of the unseen. It's not the place of evil. It's the place of the unseen. This is all the things that exist in the world that you do not see or hear. This is the richest place in the world. Why was Pluto the king of riches? Why was the underworld the place of riches? Because all the riches are hidden in this world because we are still learning to stick our fish into the glue and pull a fish out and go, holy shit, I think I can see through this thing now. I can smell things. I can render this white glue and show currents and eddies. And it allows me, if we keep doing this 50,000 years from now, we're going to be able to see a fish. We're going to be able to render what that fish looks like, how big it is. And for all intents and purposes, we'll think it's real. And at no point will it ever be false, because no matter what, if we stick our hand in exactly the right time and we grab that, we're going to come out with a fish. So that means everything is true. Every single thing that we saw must be true because it worked.
Makes sense indeed. Well, do you have a question, Vance, or the clone that replaced you when you dropped out for a second?
Well, yeah, I was wondering, as far as you were saying about, that babies are, don't have a particular sex when they're born. What about the X and Y chromosomes? Isn't it pretty well established that we have X and Y chromosomes? That's what determines what genitals develop.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, so at no point in time does that change. We're born with these genetic markers, but our pituitary hasn't written that code yet. So it's like when you're born, your eyes are still, they are still building themselves. Most of your brain is still building itself, right?
Yeah.
And so the time it takes for you to build itself is actually the time where you're creating, you're writing to your own log file. And if you were to clone yourself after 2 years old, you would have already had pre-sight training for sight itself. So coming back to this question, you're always going to have those chromosomes, but we discover our puberty as we grow older. We step into who we are and how we're going to genderfy ourselves, basically. So the chromosomes are always there, but until we become aware of them, until our software is able to plug into them, I think we haven't actually found our identity yet in that gender part of it. And that's what takes a while.
Yeah, certainly you don't get the certain sexual feelings until you're a certain age. You know, the hormones start flowing, right? Mm-hmm. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, definitely that, but even so I found the whole what's happened in our culture from the time I grew up in high school, there was never an issue with gender dysphoria or dysmorphia was never a thing that you saw. It wasn't really a concept. It was something that I saw on TV that was kind of joked about, but that was it. That was about the extent of it. And now we're looking at a world where that's a much more deep trench of thought. And there's just a lot more things hanging around there. I think that's showing you the resolution has gotten higher. Our resolution, our ability to identify into something has gotten so thick that we've seen it overflow through the gender. And now we have all these different words and pronouns that we use. It's really more that they're just showing you that the drum of how we identify with ourselves has so much more resolution now. That the old categories that we kept are not doing a good job anymore. So we're expanding on them.
Makes sense. So do you want to talk about the color blue? You mentioned associating blue with Hades, and we kind of started it in our last interview about the importance of blue. And as we were talking, blue is a color we had to invent or discover, right? And it's a very prevalent color in your book.
Yeah. We basically hallucinate blue, the fovea, which holds most of the receptors that render color to you through the use of opsin and riboxins. The amount of receptors that actually receive blue is a very, very low number. Too low to associate how much blue most of us actually see. When we look at the sky, for example. And so we enhance this color in some way. And I think we're at the beginning of understanding that if we're enhancing blue, we're actually enhancing everything we see. And I think this is a hard thing for people to accept and to kind of come to grips with what's happening. So blue is just the start, in my opinion. And the reason why blue is something new is in my opinion, we don't really have like a direct answer on this, but it's probably because again, we've gained a wider drum of consciousness, just like we're able to see ourselves as more than a binary. For example, we're going to see ourselves more than deeper than in 12 colors. So I think we're still seeing ourselves for who we are. We just simply expanded our palette more. And with that palette expansion, there just becomes a necessity to kind of create more words for it. So right now, blue just happens to be the final frontier of our color spectrum. But even magenta has the same process. Even as we're learning to look at additive colors versus subtractive colors or RGB versus CMYK, we're learning to hallucinate different color sets, all from using cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. So that right there is a kind of hallucination. The mores that you see on a newspaper, I believe that we had to be taught to look at them as a black and white image, because if you were to take a magnifying glass, you just see black circles. Some black circles are bigger, some black circles are smaller, and that your brain is hallucinating the picture that's there. It's giving you the stable diffusion of the dots. That's giving you the latent space to where you can imagine what's there. I think ultimately this is actually how our reality is actually happening. It's not actually what we see is what's there. What we see is what we hallucinated out of the latent space, and we decided this is the most accurate representation. Reality is about accuracy. Mm-hmm. It's not about precision. Those sound the same, so we can use any other word you want, but the goal is in reality is not to come up with the truth. The goal is to come up with something that works. And I can prove that to you, because so many times that's really all that matters. And once we have something that works, we just go to bed. We just move on to the next problem. And we'll always do that, because there's too many problems to solve. It'll take light years, I think, until we come back to start to go, well, why don't we look at what's actually true versus what actually works? So what's working is to have two genders that people associate into in puberty, and that puberty is held a little bit higher than normal. So puberty is maybe 15 or 16, the social networks doing that. If you were to leave people by their own devices in the woods, I'm just guessing, but I think puberty would probably be more like 10 or 11. I just think that without the cultural moorings there, that the pituitary works more, and that you're able to stave it off least. So with cloning, all that's out the window, because these gears have already unwound in you. These processes have already decided that your favorite color is green. So now you're born and you fucking hate green, but something has been telling you that your favorite color is green. Now you could argue, well, you wouldn't have that, James, because it's built in. And this is why I love this subject. Yeah, it's profound, but it also could be that underneath that layer, underneath that haunting that your favorite color is green, you are thriving and you freaking love puce. You think puce is the greatest color that's ever been born. It's the most underrated color ever. And how do you come out with that? And so you end up being a contrarian, and people don't know why you're a contrarian. And maybe the reason why you're a contrarian is because you're epigenetically wrestling with your own hauntings that have come before. So these things define us, right? They don't break us. They define us. I don't think that we'd exist if we didn't have these hauntings. There's no way. We'd be too automaton anyway. And I think we dive in because we'd be too predictable. So this is about a profundity here in understanding who and what we are and how we actually function, I think.
Very well said. Yeah. And in your book, you talk about the importance of blue. I think, again, this is a blue man. He talks about, or maybe it's you, and Krishna wasn't the only blue lord. Rama, Vishnu, Kali, and Shiva were also blue. The Egyptian gods Amun and Amun were blue. Amun's name means the hidden one. We're back at Hades. Our mythology tells us the lord of Hades is blue again. The link between the blue and unseen. And for the audience, there were ancient cultures who had no color blue. Homer, Indian writings, they call it green or wine color. Even today in your book, there are Aborigines who have no color blue. Mm-hmm. It's green. Even if you show them blue, they're like, oh, green.
Yes.
And thoughts I have on that, it reminds me of the story of people with blue eyes, James. They say that once upon a time, all people, humans, had brown eyes, but there was some virus or something changed 10,000 years ago. They're arguing whether it was Scandinavia mm-hmm. or Egypt. I always go for Egypt, but blue is a scarring of some viral trauma that humanity went through 10,000 years ago. Dune's very popular right now. What happens mm-hmm. when you have the spice and you see God? Your yeah. eyes turn blue. And lastly, going to Elvis, there was this weird habit sandwiched in between, you know, occult theosophists in the 20s, 30s, for Manly P. Hall and the hippie New Ages in the 60s. There was this weird group, which Elvis was part of, and Larry Geller. I don't know if they're proto New Agers or past occultists, but blue was really big for Elvis and his spiritual people who work spiritually. When Elvis healed, and he would heal, I mean, there's so many instances of healing, heart attacks, headaches, whatever. He had to focus on the color blue. He had to get it up and do the blue thing. And
wow,
there's a story when he was born, a blue light fell on his house. Blue was a color that he used in most of his songs, movies, and the day he died, there was blue everywhere. He sang a song with blue. He put on blue pajamas, there's this blue everywhere. And I'm not the first to notice. People were just wondering that blue and Elvis's mystical side and an occultist in those days was really the color of God or mysticism. Mm, so
yeah,
some of my thoughts there, James.
Yeah, yeah. And when you think about, if you asphyxiate, you turn blue, and so you become dead. You enter into the world of Hades. You step in. Rama was said to, or Krishna was said to, the reason why Krishna was blue is because the world is so dirty that it turned him blue. And so it was the world's lies made his skin turn blue. And so all the lies would be the same analogy as the world that's unseen. And so in order for us to keep lies going, we toxify them with this blue sort of hiddenness to them. And as we get more advanced, we have to look at blue more, and it freaks us out. So really, we're just looking at an archaic form of things that were stuffed under the rug 20,000 years ago, and that now we've gotten advanced enough to where we can see them. Like alcohol is a perfect example of that. The Bacchus itself, the alcoholism that you're seeing now is the animism has become more realitized. It's become hallucinated into the world, and now we have the Super Bowl, and this is what it looks like now. So as we get better at looking at all, I think that's why there's so many frauds now. Like, there's all these different fields. We're seeing all this new fraud cases come out, and people are explaining it as if, I've never seen fraud this rampant ever. And it's like, yeah, I know, because you've never seen the world this rampant ever before. And so you're just looking at the world now for what it truly is. And if we can show courage, and if we can keep looking at this, if we can keep looking into this concept, if we developed a love for the blues, how fitting is it that when we play the blues, we close our eyes and we feel it? And that, why are you playing sad music and why is everyone happy? Because it's giving you this same clue, right? That the color of things that are unseen are going to be sad and painful at first, and that you can find a way to romanticize that difficulty. So this is why Orpheus uses music to travel into the underworld to rescue his dead wife. He uses music because this is the only medium that he would have to communicate with a place that's literally invisible to him. So he calls forth what he wants, this magic of the bident. Hades is the place of the bident, where Poseidon is the place of the trident, and that these three worlds were, you could look at as your id, your ego, and your superego. And so really, Hades itself is inside of you. The Sheol is your id, I believe. And so when we are aware of what our id truly wants, just to really quickly say, your id may want to, I want to take and acquire this sex or this beer or this food or this gold or this that. And that the id could have this very debasing, quote, quote, evil, unseen, uncomfortable motivation. And that the first thing you would do is hide that from yourself. So when we look about what Hades really is, it's easier for us to see it in the outside world. But when we're ready to see it in ourselves, well, now we're cooking with gas. Because your cranial spinal fluid, you could look at as the climbing down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench would be going all the way to the deepest parts of your cranial spinal fluid. And that down there is the ruling of Hades. This is all your sexual urges, your olfactory urges, the inner essence of your id would be all these things that you've gone to so much effort to hide yourself from. That's why when babies are born, we turn off this olfactory gland inside of our mouth. We shut it off. And I think ultimately, that's why this book describes smell and Hades as being really synonymous with the same things, because all the truths that you know are expressed in your chemo signals. You cannot lie through evaporation. Your pores are never going to lie about your intentions. So no matter what you say, your smell that you emanate from your reef is going to be detected by everyone in the room, because Hades is here. It's just that all of us are in unison agreeing to ignore each other's deeper smell, because frankly, it's the only way we can be comfortable around each other.
Well said indeed. Well, I'd like to do a little housekeeping, as they say, and announce more or less formally, because James will be joining us, and I hope to see you there, to please join us at the Astronosis Conference. Tickets are on sale August 9 and 10 at the Theosophical Society. It was amazing last year, and this year the theme will be Sophia and Simulated Realities. More speakers, more workshops, more social events. This is the preeminent Gnostic conference, so check it out. Yes, I am scrolling down for those of you who are watching on video. 20% off until the end, until May 1st. I got to fix that. But yes, so you have about another month to get your discount tickets, and it's going to be truly amazing. I mean, we love talking here on the internet and everything, but I'm sure James agrees. There's nothing like one-on-one real conversation. I mean, you realize you are living kind of in a false world, but when you just get to hang out underneath a tree or in a hallway and exchange coffee and really important information, that's when the magic happens. So, and that's why one of the reasons I do these things, other than to try to share the best possible information out there, Theosophical, is because, yeah, human connections is where we will reach the color blue and unveil Hades. So James will be presenting, still working on the schedule and some of the guests, more guests like Ola Wolny and Rhyme are trying to get their visas to fly from Japan and Scandinavia. But right now we got Mitch Horowitz, Rhyme, Richard Smoley, Christopher Knowles, Jason Reza Giorgiani, Steven Snyder, James True, David Block, and more to come. And again, it'll be 2 days of presentations, high level presentations, Q&A, panels, social events afterwards that are a blast, gift and swag. So here's just some examples, and I hope to see you there. There's James on one of the panels, and then there's James here, the Placenta in Egypt, the Oracle of Mythology, incredible presentation. So that is the housekeeping for today. And yeah, please support Aeon Biden any way you can. Definitely support James. Let's see. This is his website, jtrue.com. Well, I still have this. Well, the screen share still works. So James is always putting great stuff, how to get his book by avoiding evil Amazon and get a signed copy, blog posts, all the fun stuff is there on his website and all of his books and resources and everything. So definitely help out James as the real Great Reset happens and the end of the world gets closer, and it's going to be a revolution of the mind. So that's the housekeeping. Vance, any questions from you? Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.